What do pastors and comedians share in common? What's it like to go on a theological journey from a Nazarene upbringing to a vineyard church to finding your Calvinistic roots and finally ending up on a teaching team at an Anglican church? Writing mystery novels and telling that story in your preaching. What's the difference between a sermon and a homily? And more importantly, how do Psalm 61, 2 Samuel 16, and John 6 work together in a Sunday morning message? Today we have a conversation with Mike McNichols.
Hey everybody, welcome to the Teaching Pastor Podcast. Today we are here with a legend in Fuller Theological Seminary, Mike McNichols. Mike is he is the director of the Orange County Regional Campus of Fuller Theological Seminary, but little known fact, in a previous life, Mike was a vineyard pastor and church planter. Is that right?
That's right.
Right. Now, that I am sure there are stories that you could tell that would, I don't know, like curl the hair on our...
Absolutely. Even if you have hair left.
And do people still have hair left? Are you still associated with the Vineyard Church?
I'm kind of a friend of the Vineyard. I don't pastor Vineyard Church anymore.
Okay.
But I still keep my friends intact.
Yeah, you still have good friendships. And you are also a closet Nazarene.
I was raised up as a Nazarene.
Yes.
Yeah, I come from that heritage, the holiness heritage.
The holiness heritage.
Yep.
Wesleyan. And now, but now you've traded in all of those stripes for being part of the teaching team at Holy Trinity Anglican Church.
That's right. Believe it or not, there are links connecting all these things together, but that's probably a different story, isn't it?
Yeah, well, I mean, it's certainly, how does a Nazarene vineyard, it's like a denominational refugee camp, it sounds like, as you're the leader of a ragtag band of refugees. So what is a little bit of that like as we start to get into this?
Well, the movement from the Holiness Nazarene world to the Vineyard world was one of really being nurtured early on in a context of having a desire and a sense to experience God, but finding more life in this new movement called the Vineyard that we connected with my wife and I in the early 1980s. But those Wesleyan holiness bones never quite go away from the body. And I like to say when I came to Fuller Seminary, I didn't have any Reformed bones in my body, only Wesleyan bones. But now at this point in my life, I still have Wesleyan bones, but Reformed cartilage. And I'm good with that.
The muscle tissue. I don't know. Can you say that? I mean, you've got the structure. You've got the structure and the founding of a Wesleyan, a really hearty Wesleyan tradition. And
right.
Some meat on those bones.
That's
well.
Right. Sure. I don't find that incompatible at all. But connecting with the Anglican tradition, and there's some vineyard connections there too, friends who have migrated that way. But it's also a sort of homecoming. After all, Wesley himself was an Anglican.
Yeah, that's correct.
And so there's a lot that is reminiscent, but in a new and strongly liturgical way that I've come to appreciate.
That's fantastic. Well, and being at Fuller, you are this is part of the of the experience now of life and the rhythms. What do you teach here at Fuller?
I teach courses that are more designed for formation. We call them integration courses. I also teach an occasional mission course.
Okay.
So that's kind of the world I navigate here.
Okay, and so on the faculty and intercultural studies.
Right.
Okay.
Yep. That's my school.
Fantastic. Well, that's great, and I know that you're big also in spiritual formation and teach the Touchstone courses for that. So,
right.
Love seminary students.
Absolutely. What's not to love?
Well, what is not to love? I mean, shoot, they'll keep you on your toes. But
That's
also means that you love pastors, right?
Right.
And you probably have had great experience in terms of diving into the text of Scripture.
Yeah.
You are an author and we'll talk about, because you are also a man of mystery. You write mystery novels.
Yes. Right? But, thrillers.
Yeah, we'll have to. So I want to talk a little bit, get into that a little bit about how that creative process works and going from text to message, but also how does that play into writing this stuff. So where do you preach at now? What is it like to be on the teaching team at Holy Trinity Anglican?
Well, I preach not on a regular basis, but when I'm needed. I also preach at another Anglican church that is a plant from Holy Trinity in another community here in Orange County. But I also get called upon to preach in a variety of settings. Just because of my role here at Fuller, I sometimes will have a student or someone I've gotten to know ask me to preach at their church. So it's been pretty broad. I preach in a Presbyterian church, a Christian and Missionary Alliance church, non-denominational churches. It's really a fun experience to be with fellow Christians in all kinds of tribes. You really come to appreciate these expressions.
Yeah, no doubt, no doubt. Now, what was it like for a young Mike McNichols back when you were planting Vineyard House churches to bring a message every week? And how has that changed over the years? So just, if you don't mind getting in a time machine and going back to those early days, fresh and at a seminary and now and planting a church.
Well, when it comes to church planting and pastoral ministry, there never was such a thing as a young Mike McNichols. I was 45 when I planted my church.
Wow.
So I was coming out of a business career and really seeking God's calling to change the direction of my vocational life. And so we planted a church when I was 45 years old, my wife and I. And what was interesting being a part of the Vineyard is that they were okay that I had not finished seminary. They saw that I had people who were kind of following me and my wife and I in a small group setting, and they thought it might be a good idea. So off we went. I was only halfway through my time at Fuller. I don't think I'd taken even a communication course yet. I'd done a lot of communicating, but never any real preaching. So it was absolutely terrifying, is what it comes down to. And I thought, this is going to be really easy. And it wasn't really easy. It was really difficult.
Yeah, what terrified you? Like, what was the thing that... Because one of the questions is, everybody gets excited about doing some things about preaching or teaching or getting in the Bible. But there's other things that just put you in the fetal position. So what was terrifying about it?
Well, first of all, the first terror was coming up with 40 minutes of content, because that was kind of the structure back then. 40 minutes was our deal. And but I think the thing that really weighed heavily on me is just the sense of responsibility that I'm somehow diving into this ancient text, and I'm supposed to help bring something to these people that is meaningful and not off the rails in some fashion. And it's pretty easy to go off the rails, especially when your training was as scant as mine was in those days. My intentions were good, but my training was scant. And but at the same time, I was very, very concerned about that my church would grow with people who were seekers, who were new to faith. I didn't want to have a super seeker-friendly context, but I wanted to be really aware of those people. So all the time I'm thinking about, how do I do this in a way that speaks to the seasoned veteran Christian and the one who's walking in the door thinking, what in the world is going on here? I felt that weight very heavily, and I found it a challenge to navigate those two poles. That was a heavy deal.
So when you're in the text and you're thinking about getting, was that more of a tension that you felt when you were actually in the text studying, or when you were kind of standing at the crossroads of what stays in and like what makes it off the cutting room floor, what keeps in, what goes out? And or was that more like once you got up and you're like, am I interesting enough for all these people?
Yeah.
Where did you feel that most?
I think I felt it most in the middle and third section, the part where you're really trying to pull things together. You've done your study, you've done your exegetical work, and I knew enough to do that, and now you're packaging it. How do I communicate this to this population of people? How do I do it in a way that's meaningful and even relevant to, so that they can simply understand what's going on? And how do I do it in such a way that allows them to kind of push the envelope a little bit, rather than restating to them all the things they already think they know? How do I push them and myself beyond that? But then when you stand up on that little, I preached from a music stand for 10 years. I never had quite a pulpit. But you look around and you say, what do I see right today at this very moment? In a smaller church, and my church was, you know, hundreds or so, you can tell if there's people there and you don't know who they are. And you start asking yourself, what's the deal with this person? You try to sort that out even before you even talk to the person. And you wonder the entire time, am I even coming close here?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I can relate. Every time, I mean, it doesn't matter how much I'm prepared or not. I get nervous anytime I get ready to stand up in front of people. And And I mean, you know, we both have advanced degrees, and I don't know how you get around that. And maybe that's just a psychological issue.
I heard an interview with Woody Allen once, and that he would be so nervous before doing a stand-up routine. Mm-hmm. Now, this is many, many, many years ago. And a fellow comedian was in the green room with him. They're waiting for their turns on this one show. And the guy talked Woody into sitting down and centering himself and getting quiet. And Woody Allen went out and bombed the whole deal. Because for him, nervousness was part of the preparation.
Part of his shtick, too.
Yeah, and it kept right. him, but it kept him sharp.
Right.
And
right.
I think part of it is it comes with the territory. Part of it is because we take this seriously. And there's a nervousness that I think goes beyond, I'm going to stand in front of people. We get accustomed to that over time. And that's not the part that makes us nervous. It's the weight of the thing that makes you nervous.
Yeah. You know, it's funny that you make the connection between stand-up comedians and preachers.
Yeah.
I was watching Jerry Seinfeld's Comedians in Cars Getting Coffee, and he interviews these comedians. And I just was struck at the kind of parallels between what a comedian has to do and what a pastor has to do. Both have to get up and get a response from their audience, and they both have to do it with basically no props. Like unless you're Gallagher, right? Or you know, PowerPoint or whatever. Sometimes PowerPoint is kind of like
an exploding watermelon.
Yeah. But it is, it's like you get up there kind of naked, and you have to speak something meaningful, something that could be potentially life-changing, and mine it out of scripture or create it ex nihilo, you know, and just like, okay, here we are. So it's fascinating to me, anybody who can get up in front of people and hold people's attention with just their words. That is a fascinating, fascinating thing for me. So that, if that gets you nervous, like what did you enjoy? What do you enjoy about the preparation process? Like, where do you get energy from that?
You know, I had a friend after I'd been pastoring for a handful of years, 3-4 years, and finished my degree at Fuller. So I felt much more confident in what I was doing. And plus a few years under your belt, you do learn some things and you study a lot and you do all that. And a friend of mine who'd been a pastor for 20 some odd years, he and I were talking, and he asked me how I felt about preaching every single week.
Yeah.
He says, "Don't you get tired of it, though?" Because he apparently did. And I had to say that I didn't. And I never did. Even when times were tough in the life of the church, that was the most life-giving thing of my week. And to this day, I thoroughly enjoy. To me, it's always a point of discovery. It's like an expedition, you know. Now, I've seen these texts. I read through the Bible on a constant basis. And so the texts are always somewhat familiar to me. But I always know that when I start mining, there's going to be gold in there somewhere. There's going to be things that I've never thought about before. And to me, that's the most exciting thing.
Wow, that is. Man, I'll tell you, I remember talking to a pastor, and he said he had gotten a senior pastor position. And he said, "I got that preaching thing out of my system." And I was like,
"That's too bad."
I don't know what honestly, I mean, I might not necessarily want to stand up in front of people every week, but the idea of the time and energy spent in the text to mine it and to find treasure that is undiscovered, for whether it's for me or for other people, or I mean, that's like in academia, that's like finding Sasquatch, you know?
It's yeah,
like, it's
right.
It's like a Bigfoot sighting. I found something no one else has ever seen. Now you're like, oh, I can write a paper. But the height of all communication, right?
A
seminar paper. But so tell me about that process. Like, how do you go about doing that? What are the sort of tools that you use? How are your original languages? Do you use multiple translations? Like, when you're sitting down, like, how does that work for you? I mean, you were just preaching, you said you had just preached on at the Anglican Church on what passages?
I was looking at 2 Samuel 16 and John 6.
Yeah, and of course those go together because...
Well, yeah, that was interesting. The only, you know, when you preach in a more in a sacramental and liturgical environment, if they're preaching with the lectionary, you don't get to pick your text.
Right.
They are given to you. And I've come to really appreciate that because left to my own devices, I'll pick the text I like the best. But when you preach through the lectionary, you wrestle with things that you did not choose.
Yeah.
And I find that to be not only challenging, but life-giving. So what was given to me was the Psalm, which is in Psalm 61, but 2 Samuel 16, because there's a thematic thing going on about suffering. I don't know about the life of David, and that this particular week it was on suffering. So I was asked to pick a gospel text to go along with it. So I had a little freedom here. So I just sat and thought about it for a while, and I chose John 6, where Jesus begins talking about the consuming of his body, his blood, and he loses a whole bunch of his disciples. In fact, he loses all of them but the original 12. And I chose that because I began thinking, first of all, about the 2 Samuel text. David's escaping with his life from Jerusalem. His son Absalom has a conspiracy against him. He's back outside the city. He's in trouble again. Things are a mess. And this guy starts throwing rocks at him and cussing at him and saying, "You're a murderer and you're a scoundrel." And David won't allow his men to kill this guy because he knows he is one. Not for the reasons the guy thinks. He thinks it's because of Saul. But David knows his background, and he's already paid the price for his adultery and murder. But he's still suffering in it, and he takes it. He just receives it. And I thought, where in the gospel, besides the obvious road to the crucifixion? And I thought, when Jesus had those people leave, I asked myself this question: did he suffer? Now, he didn't suffer because he had committed a crime, but he suffered a loss because he spoke something that was deep and true and something that people had never heard before. And we often talk about Jesus as though he's dispassionate about these kinds of things. But when he turns to the remaining 12 and he says, "Do you also wish to leave?" There's a sense of sadness in that. There's a sense of disappointment, like, maybe I'm going to be all alone again here. And I thought, there's a kind of suffering that runs parallel to what David's dealing with, and that is the suffering of being truthful, being honest, and having everybody walk out on you. So I tried to tie those two things together under the larger banner of suffering. And again, for me, that was part of the kind of treasure hunt.
Yeah.
Of exploring the concept of suffering through the text.
Yeah. Was there anything that surprised you in either of those texts? Like just something that didn't make it into the sermon, but just on the cutting room floor, but was pretty meaningful at the time?
Well, actually, something that did surprise me that did make it in, never fell to the cutting room floor, was, to the conclusion you try to come to about this whole issue of suffering, because there's a lot of canned responses to why people suffer. And I kind of had to explore those in my message in order to get to my point. But what was fascinating about these things is that to determine that in the suffering, in those two examples, suffering that David went through and the suffering that Jesus went through, it never lands in a statement of purpose of the suffering. In other words, the suffering occurred so that, and then you can fill in the blank. Mm. It's always a sense of suffering with the two sufferers, both David and Jesus, with doing nothing more than submitting themselves to God. That in David's suffering, he knows he earned it. He knows he earned it. And rather than kill the accuser and airbrush the problem from history, he simply says, "Who knows? This could be God at work." And he submits himself to that. He submits himself to the God who has always been with him, has never left him. And Jesus also, who claimed that he only did what he saw his Heavenly Father doing, is prepared to stand alone, to be abandoned, and to submit himself to the very presence of God. So in both of those situations, much like you experience in the book of Job, you know, you go through all these chapters of this dialogue, and at the end of it all, God doesn't bring any answers to this. He just says, "I'm God and you're not, and let's get down to business."
Yeah.
That kind of thinking informs these texts in some ways. That in the end, we don't have the answers to these things. The why is this happening? The God, what are you doing? Is not the right question to be asked in the first place. The right question is, how do I respond to God in this place?
Huh.
So that's where that's the thing I discovered. I thought, if the glib answers aren't the satisfactory ones, what is? And it's that, how do I respond to God?
Wow. So even in our very pragmatic culture, I'll go through anything if I can see the benefit on the backside.
Right.
And what you're saying in these passages is neither of these people had anything to gain on the backside except the gain of simply being obedient mm-hmm. to the call of God.
And with the deep confidence that God was present to them, even in that moment.
Mm. Yeah. How did Psalm 61 fit into that?
Well, I didn't choose it. So Psalm 61 just ended up being the prayer of trust that surrounded that.
Okay.
And I actually, because we, in that setting, all of those texts are read, and a couple of them were long. They were read, and we did Psalm 61 that morning as a responsive reading. So it had been the corporate prayer already of the church. And so I didn't feel compelled to wind that into my sermon as well. The two other texts were sufficient to make the connection.
Yeah. So that's interesting because you did all of that in
20 minutes,
like a 20-minute homily.
Yeah. I timed it three times.
and that is an interesting thing because you had in your vineyard experience, you've got 40 minutes, fill it up,
or more if you feel like it,
or more if the Spirit leads.
Right. That's
vineyard, right. And now 20 minutes with liturgy on both sides, and also knowing that you've got the Lord's Supper, the Eucharist is coming,
right?
And that's the centerpiece, not the homily.
Correct.
So how does that change the way you approach? Obviously, your study is probably going to be very similar in the text,
right?
But you've got to do some serious work on getting it
down to 20 minutes.
Yeah, down to 20 minutes.
Well, there's no room for fluff, you know? So all the funny stories and quotes that you just love to throw in, those are out. And I don't freeform it. I've done that. The problem is I don't trust myself to stay on point when I do that. And so I, because I don't speak every single week, I've got time to process the text. And I read them over and over and I consult my commentaries. I would like to say I do full translations, but I don't. But I do consult.
You mean you didn't translate the Hebrew of 2 Samuel and the Greek of John? Well, you didn't do that?
Because I have them both memorized, I kind of don't need to, you know? I don't even have my kids' phone numbers memorized, but anyway.
But let's just talk about that for a second because we are at Fuller Seminary and we've had training. How do you access? Obviously, it's not as sharp and fresh. Like, my Hebrew is not sharp and fresh. My Greek is sharp and fresh. But how do you access that original language stuff? And how are you looking at the text? Are you using Bible software? Are you using BDAG? I mean, what are you using when you do get into the... I'm not saying in this last sermon or this last message, but when you do, how are you accessing it?
I use software.
Okay, what kind? Yeah. What is it?
Well, I've got Bible Works. And I also... There's a couple of them that are just free online that you can access as a quick study. Like if I'm working through the text and I'm all of a sudden thinking, that phrase right there, wait a second. And then I can jump right over to that.
Right.
It's a functional thing. I keep Bible Works on a separate computer, so I just have to go dig it out, you know, that whole thing.
It takes up a lot of memory.
Yes, it does. Yes. So there is that piece. But I use the text I usually use is the New Revised Standard Version. I've just gotten accustomed to that over 20 years, and I like it. But I also consult other translations just to kind of see how a phrase is being spun, depending on the context.
Do you have favorites that you kind of go to on that?
In terms of other texts,
translations.
I will look at the NIV. I will look at the New Living Translation, New American Standard. I go back to the New American Standard. It's a tough one to just read this the way it's laid out, but it's still a good one to lay alongside the others. And that's about it. That's about what I use.
I like NASB because it in the issue of being transparent to the original text. It might not read very well, but you can say, oh, this word is this word in Hebrew or this word in Greek or this idiom or something like that. It is a horrible Bible to read out loud from. I mean, it's just tongue-tying.
It is.
But apologies to all, you know, NASB people. But it's difficult.
Yeah. But it's a legit translation. Yeah.
So you use a multiple translations. Uh-huh. You're using some website. What website?
You know what? I forget the name of it. I've got it on my desktop.
Something like Blue Letter Bible or...
I think it's just called Greek Bible.
Okay, Greek
Bible.
Greek
Bible. Yep.
Oh, great. And then you've got your Bible Works software, which is what Fuller has been using.
Yes. I bought it a long time ago.
Okay. Yeah.
Yeah.
So, and I use Accordance. And so there's obviously different ways of looking at this. So that's good. So you're, and then do you have commentaries? So what were you using for the 2 Samuel, for John?
Well, I look at a variety of them. The fact that the campus where I serve, there's 15 feet from me, there's our library. It's not a big library, but it's good enough for that. And so I'll check every single commentary we've got, depending on what I'm working on. And I think having done all that, I think the part that is the most thrilling for me is when you sit down there on that blank page. Now you've read through the text all those times, and it's in your head. And I write a series of questions and highlight certain things. I'm thinking, well, what about this? But what would he have done in that situation? What would he be thinking? Mm-hmm. So I do a lot of things that a novelist ought to do, and ask questions of speculation, basically, not speculation outside of the text, but within the text, as to what would that have been like. For example, I asked myself, what would it have been like for Jesus, on an emotional level, to lose everybody that was hanging with him? Because in that context, as in ours, having a lot of followers is a sign of success. Mm-hmm. Now when they all turn and run, how does that feel? Even relationally, how does it feel? And so those are the kinds of questions I put down. But
I love that kind of painting that sociological picture.
Yes,
it seems to me like that really enriches the text. Or even asking the question, what would it have been like for David to be walking and having things thrown at him and people accusing him? But just filling that in and painting that picture. Seems like a natural movement of mm-hmm. a biblical interpreter,
rather than
stepping away from the text to actually be invited into saying, "Oh my gosh, what would this have been like?"
Yeah.
And to paint that. And you are a novelist.
I'm working on it.
Yeah, well, you're a published novelist, which is more than most can say. But so painting that picture, like, how does that?
Yeah.
What are the parallels in that, and how does that help your preaching?
Well, whenever you're writing, especially, you know, when in writing fiction, you do what everybody thinks that you do. You get stuck. You have a blank page and you just stare at it for a while. But the best way to get going is just to get going. And so I do that with my sermon as well. I begin to think about, how would I open this up to a body of people that they would connect with whatever's going to happen next? You know, that first line or first paragraph in a mystery novel or a thriller novel that you read, if it doesn't hook you, then you might not get hooked at all. By the same token, in preaching, I want to be able to say something at the initial part that's consistent with where the sermon is going to go, but opens the door for people to step in. And so that if I can get that first piece on paper, then the rest of it starts to flow. And it may hit fits and starts along the way, as it probably should, but it begins to flow at that point. And then I let my research that I've done, my study that I've done, and my imagination go to work and to weave this thing together. To me, that's where the greatest fun is, if it's okay to have fun while writing a sermon.
Right.
That's where the greatest fun is in that process, is taking those resources and bringing them to that blank sheet on my computer, that blank screen on my computer, mm-hmm. and begin letting it come to life. And along the way, I always pray, God, may this stumbling effort on my part be word of God for these people in some fashion.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and we're, so just a practical question. So you like to use a computer, you're not a typewriter guy.
Right.
I know that some people, I saw on Microsoft Word you can go into like no distraction mode in Microsoft Word,
really?
Where it like takes the whole desktop and all you have is your blank sheet of paper, kind of like typewriter-esque. I don't know if it mutes out everything else. I could mute out those Adobe upgrade.
Yeah, that would work.
Messages, but
yeah.
But you prefer typing, not handwriting.
Yeah. My handwriting is atrocious. So, and it's my own handwriting. It's too slow for me. Because I can't catch up with myself, and I'd start losing my thoughts that are coming into me if I'm just doing it on paper. Now, I get that people have done this for thousands of years, and the computer thing is relatively new.
Right.
I'm just saying that's what works for me. I had the opportunity three different times to meet the science fiction writer Ray Bradbury when he was alive. And it was, and I heard him say to another fellow who was talking to him, I was waiting for my turn, and the guy asked him if he used one of these newfangled machines called a word processor. This was back in the 80s. And he says, no, I do my work on an IBM Selectric 2. He says, that's my favorite tool.
That's his tool.
That was his tool.
Yeah.
And he didn't do it by hand either. And so I found that by doing that, it does keep me focused, and it keeps me in motion faster than I can be if I did it by hand.
Right. Now, is there... is your muse LaCroix drink, soda, or can you call it soda? I mean, it's water.
It's
flavored water.
It's bubbly
water.
Yeah. It's hipster water.
It is hipster water, and you are a hipster, Mike. Is it coffee? Like, what do you have, a food that's a muse, or do you like a drink, or what is your...
For me, it's usually coffee, because my best writing time is in the morning.
Okay.
For anything.
Yeah.
And so I usually have a cup of coffee there. And sometimes nothing. But I do have kind of one of two spots in my home that I sit in when I'm writing. And I don't play music. I need a window I can look out, however, okay. Because if my mind's going to wander and I want to look at a tree or something, and have something that's of beauty that I can glance at once in a while. And I have places in my home where I can do that. But I'm pretty minimalist when it comes to that. I do need it quiet, though.
You do need quiet.
I do need quiet.
No music. No music. No earbuds.
I mean, I love classical music, but I love all kinds of music, and I listen to it with a critical ear. So when I'm listening to Bach, I go, now on that part over there, and I get lost. I just need it quiet.
Right, just quiet, but not like coffee shop, not like quiet,
nope.
like a hum, a low grade.
No, there are some circumstances where I can do that and shut it out, but it's when I am so into what I'm writing that it doesn't matter what's going on. But most of the time, if I'm really kind of grinding through and trying to get the wheels to spin, it really needs to be quiet.
Yeah. Is there with this last sermon, or maybe there was a time, but where did you? We can talk about the study time in 2 Samuel and John and getting ready to preach it, but where was God at for you in that process? I mean, you had some time to sit and reflect on the passage. It wasn't like you had a few weeks out to think about this.
Mm-hmm.
And obviously, for some pastors, Sunday is always coming. I mean, and it's relentless. And, you know, sometimes it's almost like, well, if God's going to show up, you better do it quick, because we got to move.
Time's a wasting.
But so how did you feel like God showed up? How was your soul in that whole process with preparing for this? How much time did you have from start to finish, from beginning to actually preaching the message? And where did you see God work in that?
You know, that's a very interesting question. It's one of those things I think everybody who preaches and who teaches in a seminary context in particular experiences. And that is, it's one thing to tell everybody else how things are supposed to be. It's another thing to incorporate that into your own life. And I catch myself at that all the time. If I'm doing a lesson that has to do with a new spiritual discipline for this class, I have to catch myself if I've not really employed that in my own life. And I've caught myself a few times. With this particular sermon, I had several weeks to prepare. They let me know way ahead of time, which I always appreciate. So I have time to reflect on it and pray through it. But with this particular one, again, the theme on it was suffering. I wasn't going through a personal time of suffering, but my mother and father are elderly. They're in their 90s, and we have them in assisted living, and there's just all kinds of things going on that are difficult. And anyone who's been in that situation can just guess what some of those things are. And so I found myself dealing with a challenging set of family issues while at the same time trying to think through what it was like for David and Jesus to suffer in their contexts. And so the idea of suffering became more real to me as a relational dynamic than it might have if I was just simply trying to create a doctrine or trying to explain a doctrine of suffering from a Christian perspective. So for me, God was very present in the sense that this was dropped into the dynamics of my own life and experience. And not to mention the fact that I try to pause every so often every time I get myself stuck into the I have to make this happen mode to stop and let go for a moment and just say, God, will you show me how you are at work in this? And trust that he is and keep moving.
Yeah. Wow.
That's how that works for me.
Wow. It is amazing how God will bring the circumstances of our lives and the word of scripture and our charge to communicate it to people, to bring all those things together. And oftentimes just for the preacher, just for us, and to think like, wow, whether this is hitting anybody, it might not even matter.
Right.
This is what God is doing to me
right now. Right.
And
you know, that touches on another pressure that we have in preaching, and that is application. And I remember years ago when I was a pastor, I struggled with that piece. And all of a sudden one day it occurred to me that I really couldn't come up with how this applies to the lives of every single person in this room. In a way, I wanted just to ask them, you know, okay, I'm at the end of this sermon, everybody. How does this apply to your life? You know, you don't usually have that privilege to do that.
Yeah, it's like, hey, okay, hands up, everybody. You know, like,
right.
That would be.
Does it or does it not apply?
Yeah. Right. Where is this hitting you? It is. You know, sometimes you just wonder if it would be helpful to just, all right, let's have a debrief.
Right.
Like, and right. Let's just talk about what's hit you here.
Now, that's what I've come to appreciate about the more liturgical setting is that in my former setting, because so much relied on the sermon, you know, you'd have a 40-minute time of singing and worship, a 40-minute time of a message, then a time of prayer. Well, you go right from that message to the prayer time, you feel very compelled in many ways to direct your message into what would be an appropriate time of prayer ministry. Now, it's not a bad thing necessarily, but you really have to drive it. And after a while, it becomes tempting to not allow the text itself to carry the weight. Mm. Now I have to carry the weight. So what I've come to appreciate in these more liturgical settings in the Anglican Church is that, as you pointed out, the sermon is a piece of the liturgy, but it's not the whole thing, and it's only 20 minutes.
Nor is it the centerpiece.
No, it is not. The Eucharist is the centerpiece. So by the time you finish the sermon, and hopefully crafted it in such a way that people can grab a hold of it for themselves, but there's a lot of reflection that is going to take place. Up until the point that we walk out the door, there's going to be a time of confession and speaking words of absolution. We are going to pass the peace to one another. We're going to have times of silence, and we're going to share the Lord's Supper together. And oftentimes what I will encourage people to do at the end of my talk in that setting is suggest how they approach the table that morning. That as Jesus invites you to come and dine, bring this. Bring your suffering. Bring all that is you, including your suffering, to the place where Jesus has invited you today.
Oh, man.
And then they got to do that their own way. Hmm. They've got to, and that's great. The downside to the short sermon that's not the centerpiece and that's in the middle is when the service is over, not a lot of people come up and tell you anything about your sermon because they forgot that you gave it.
or they misquote you. Spirit's been speaking to them, and they're like, oh, I loved it when you said this.
Yeah, but it was 40 minutes ago, and I forgot most of it, you know? Maybe that's okay.
Oh, that's so good. It's so good. It is good, and of course, I grew up Roman Catholic, but most of my kind of Protestant formation has been in these kind of 40-minute sermon, 30-minute sermon.
Yeah.
And just to think about the richness of why a liturgical approach would be beneficial, even around the Word or around the Eucharist, or is really rich to think about. It's so good. Well, Mike, thanks so much for being part of the Teaching Pastor podcast.
My pleasure.
If anybody wants to hear one of your sermons, where might they go?
If they go to the website for Holy Trinity Church, Costa Mesa, California, the sermons that are preached every week are put on a podcast.
Okay. And we'll have that in the show notes. So thanks for tuning in. Thanks for downloading the podcast. Thanks for subscribing to us on iTunes. You can check us out on the Patreon page or on Facebook at The Teaching Pastor, or on Instagram. You can check us out any of those places. Look at us, Mike. We are total hipsters.
We're here. Everywhere.
It's everywhere. So, thanks so much for being with us, and we'll catch you guys later.
Thanks.
Hey, thanks for listening. We got a couple things just want to bring to your attention. One is there are show notes available for this episode, and they will be on the Patreon site as well as our Podbean site. And if there's anything that was mentioned here, whether it's Fuller Seminary, or listening to Mike's sermons, or Comedians in Cars Getting Coffee, or Bible Software, those will all be available in the show notes. So if you could do a couple things, one, like us on Facebook or Instagram, and then tell someone about this podcast. If you have any suggestions or ideas, let me know on theteachingpastor@gmail.com. I'd love to hear from you, and we'll catch you next time.